Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. In this daily editorial, I am chatting with Chris Ritchie. He's the president of Silvercrest Metals. Silvercrest Metals is traded on the TSX under the symbol SIL and on the NYSE under the symbol SILV. Now, on the back of a lot of the calls that I've had with Chris over almost the last year now, we usually dive a little bit into the macro fundamentals in silver, usually at the end of the call. But I've received a number of comments saying, let's get more dedicated interviews with Chris talking about some of the macro events and macro fundamentals for silver. So that's what we're going to do a lot of in this interview. I will be having Chris on to give us more of a company-specific update in the near term. But first and foremost, let's start off with a general comment on precious metals and some of the quants compared to a couple years ago. If you look back from, let's say, middle of 2019, around June through October of 2020, gold and really silver, they were some of the best performing sectors. But, well, that's drastically changed, especially for gold, as it's now one of the worst performing sectors in the last 7 months. Chris, talk about that big change that we have seen and some of the quants that saying, well, they were outperforming, now they're drastically underperforming, that being the precious metals.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's been quite interesting. I'll kind of go back a step further. If you look at the last, 10, 12 years and where the market's gone, you've seen, computers, modeling, programs, the AI, it's got a way more prominent place in the market today than ever before. Leveraged vehicles. I've heard from someone, so don't quite quote me on my numbers here, but there's three, and I won't say names, but there's three of the biggest hedge funds out there are funds that use up to 8 to 10 times leverage. And if you make 5% a year using that much leverage, you're a hero. If you lose 3% a year with that kind of leverage, you're out of a job. To capture that move in the market over the last 12 years, and you just look at a chart of the Dow and the S&P, you really get a sense of how much money's in that type of strategy. And you can also tell when we've seen these big market gyrations, it's when people with that type of strategy are getting a little bit outside of their, comfort zones. So again, the swings we have seen are pretty crazy, and the swings we will see will continue to be that with the market dynamic there. So yeah, I think you hit it a nail on the head there, Corey. Gold and silver from mid-19 to late 2020 was the number one hottest sector for fund flows. That's changed. Now it's 12th of 12 in Canada. So it's just gone completely dry. Even last year when the gold and silver space was doing quite well, we still saw outflows. There was more outflows in the space last year. So again, there hasn't been real money coming back in, but it's the money around the edges is totally gone. That said, when you start to look at the technical aspects of the market, the people that read the tea leaves for buying and selling, you can still see strong bounces. So if you look at Silvercrest, you look at the 200-day moving average, the 100-day moving average, you can see that, the long-term trend channels still remain intact. So they kind of get sold off when they hit the upper end of certain ranges, and they get bought in the bottom end of ranges that are certain support. And we trade like clockwork. So even on like a day like today, we're up like 6%. Well, you get down to that 950 range on the Canadian line, it's been pretty nice little trend line. I mean, me personally, I put my whole bonus back in the stock about 3 weeks ago, to buy more stock. I bought that 955. So again, you're seeing a different sort of pace. So I think what gets interesting is, which sort of names they can survive this downturn that actually have reasons to bounce when they hit these oversold levels? So I get excited when I see us in the sector being 12th of 12, because it allows us to talk to different types of capital. So we get excited when we see these sell-offs in the market. We get rid of that faster money, the people that are renters of the stock as opposed to true fundamental buyers, because we know they're coming back. We know that they're eventually going to be a tailwind. But again, which type of assets can weather that sort of storm? And what's beautiful for us right now is we're really lucky to have the asset we have. So with our cost structure where it is, with our financing taken care of, can you get a differentiated shareholder register? Can you find people that say, I like your defense, we understand the offense, and this is actually an investment? And there's so much money that's just whipping around the flavor of the week. Again, we're going to spend the time to try to find people that can look at the asymmetric risk reward. So yeah, we spend a lot of time looking at where that quant models, where they go. And yeah, right now the quant models are saying this is horrible.
Yeah, let's get into some of the news that came out of the ETF space too. Some of the changes in wording when it comes to the SLV and how that ETF purchases and sells silver. Can you explain to us a little bit about what these changes have to do and why using SLV as a barometer of true supply and demand and potential shortages of silver isn't exactly the best vehicle to do that with?
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll dig deeper in the actual physical market and what it takes to actually get mines into production and whatnot. But there was a changing in the wording of the SLV, and what they were stating is we don't actually necessarily have to go into the market to buy, you know, to buy silver. And, you know, from various people, what they're talking about is that there's various metals traders, you know, some of the banks that hold inventory of the silver. And when people go buy that ETF that is backed by silver, the ETF is going to the banks to buy the silver. They're not going into the physical market necessarily. They're not going into the future market necessarily. So when there's run-ups in the market, these physical metals traders are selling to the ETF. And then when, you know, let's call them the little guy, maybe less sophisticated guy, is then selling, then it's these metals traders, who this is their whole job, are buying it on the lows. So they're just making spread, you know, in and around that market without changing the supply and demand of silver itself. So I think there's a really big difference between people who are in that trade of let's create a short squeeze, let's do that. I think people need to be really careful what vehicles they're actually choosing if they're trying to express that view. You know, so actually having, you know, the miners or going into the futures market and taking delivery of the silver itself that way, going and buying physical with the traders. I mean, I had someone the other day talk about, you know, certain producers, they should have a retail arm, right? Because if you were to go online to try to buy coins today, you're not buying it at the physical price. There's a big spread. So why shouldn't the producers, you know, have the ability to sell that physical silver through their website or something along those lines? So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. But again, for people or participants playing certain vehicles, just be careful that not all these vehicles, you know, actually are taking silver off the market.
What about that PSLV, the Sprott Physical Silver Vehicle here, where they have been on record as saying they now have the ability to buy even more silver, build up their inventories? It's a little bit different compared to SLV.
Yeah, I mean, just read the wordings in these things. And I know, you know, I know Eric pretty well. He knows our story extremely well. So, I mean, they're buying the physical. They see the big long-term squeeze in this thing. They see how hard it is getting physical silver production coming onto the market. So they're not playing the short-term game. They're taking that 10,000-foot view, and they're making sure they can have that physical silver. They want the underlying metal, right? They're not in the financial markets just trying to make spread in and around creating these ETFs. Because, again, a lot of the retail brokers and whatnot, it's much easier to own an ETF. You know, as opposed to stock pick. You know, that 20 years ago or 10 years ago, the retail broker would make money on commissions, where now they, what they're trying to do and the banks are trying to do is smooth their revenue line. So they want to, you know, bring in clients and then charge them 1% of AUM just to, you know, again, not have that risk. So if Silvercrest screws up and it goes down, the broker doesn't want to make 200 phone calls to clients trying to answer to why it's in the portfolio. But if you own 4% of your portfolios in an ETF, you can say, well, that's why it was only 4%. So again, the business model of managing money has, I won't say distorted, but certainly had some pretty big impacts on how people are investing. But if we're going down to gold and silver being a store of value, and we can have the same conversation about crypto too, but if we're having those, that dialogue, yeah, find the stuff that's owning the physical silver if that's part of your thesis. You really want to have a store of value in this sort of market.
All right, let's also talk about stimulus, because it is a constant topic point for a wide range of markets, but especially precious metals. We've seen almost unlimited stimulus, especially over the last year, and now we even have a whole infrastructure bill. We'll get to the infrastructure bill later, but it's not necessarily about the actual announcement of the stimulus. It's about how money is trickling through the system. How do you view all the stimulus that we've seen, and I guess the lack of its impact in the precious metals?
Well, it's been fascinating. I mean, we've talked about this before on the show, that 21% of all the U.S. dollars ever created were created last year. And that $1.9 trillion stimulus and the $3 trillion stimulus that's being proposed, I mean, I feel like the word austerity has been removed from the dictionary. So that, you know, the MMT and what's going on with that thought process, people are saying, well, there's a risk of MMT. I'm kind of saying, we're already in it. We're way past the point of paying off of this debt. We've already made up our mind of inflating our way through it. So to me, there's two things. We talked about the quantity of money that's out in the system. Well, the velocity of that money. I mean, you go to a restaurant, if restaurants were open, you spend money, you give tips. So, well, the waiter or waitress goes out and spends money on something else. And how many times does that money turn over, you know, which creates with part of that velocity, right? So it's going to be fascinating when the economy opens back up to get a sense of that. If that velocity picks up combined with the quantity of money, well, that's a recipe for inflation. And it's finding its way into different areas too. There was a big rotation from gold and silver into oil, you know, because again, hey, people are going to be driving more, flying more with the vaccines. You know, copper, you know, you need four times as much copper for an electric vehicle as other cars, you know, and people are like, oh yeah, like, you know, we hate cars, we hate commodities. Well, a lot of the electrification, the battery metals, the transition towards that green economy, it still requires things. There was a big shift because copper is actually far more sensitive than gold and silver. So again, it's going to be quite interesting. There's not the same sort of ETFs for copper and the game playing around it. But again, those things are kind of rolling over a little bit. I think people are seeing that come back. But again, let's go back to that 10,000 foot view. The commodities in general are still in that range of 100-year lows relative to that broader market. So these little gyrations we see from time to time, I think, again, we go back to let's be patient and take a look at which vehicles can appropriately ride out the time it takes for these things to make their way through. Again, a lot of people are very short-sighted because, again, it's the flavor of the week that kind of plays out. We're trying to create a vehicle at Silvercrest that can make money for people regardless of where that commodity price is. If it takes 3 years to take hold, fine. Right? We'd like it sooner. But again, we can still thrive and survive. And I think that's one of the challenges we'd like to highlight for people is let's be careful of some of the risk profile that's happening. And that inflation isn't always just positive. Like that inflation comes through the costs. So, you know, like we want to mind the risk management portion of the business, make sure we can survive the rain for rainy days and then come out the other end with a really strong business model. And again, that's definitely worth chatting on. But yeah, that inflation is making its way through. I have a friend I was chatting with in the furniture business that had 6 price increases on a key raw material in 2 months. And the supplier said, hey, if you don't want it, I got other buyers, right? When we put out our PEA, that's the preliminary economic assessment, in May of 2019, and then we just put out our feasibility study about a month or two ago, some of our input costs, they went up 13%. So that inflation works both ways. Margins get hit. So I think any investor that has a company that is in that preliminary economic assessment phase, you know, about to come out with a feasibility study, or is in the construction phase, ourselves included, you know, to sort of get a sense of minding those cost increases and how they're potentially going to impact margins, just be cautious, be careful. Because it's going to trickle all the way through, which is long-term beneficial, because if there's no margins for producers, they're not going to be producing. They're not going to be reinvesting. They're not going to be moving projects forward. So the fact that silver, 60% of it's consumed, we need more and more of it for solar and that transition for energy metals. Again, it's the quality of asset that we have is going to survive and thrive through that. But again, you're not going to see a lot of marginal supply come online with these sorts of cost pressures, as well as being able to raise money and whatnot in a market that's, not overly constructive in the moment.
Yeah, you're right. It's not overly constructive, but some of the points you're bringing up on inflation, too, very interesting to take note of, because costs are rising, and you're even seeing that. But touching back on a news event just recently, the way that you guys have structured some of your deals is that you have some fixed price levels and contracts. Can you explain to us why the strategy was to bring those in and how it seems like they are already paying off?
Sure. I mean, our total capital required for our project is $138 million. Approximately half of that is under a fixed price contract. So that's negotiated. You know, the other party there is, if there's challenges along that road and there's cost increases, they try to bake that into the contract. So for us, we get that certainty. We get that certainty if there's any crazy events that go on, that's not borne by us. So that's half of our total capital. About 30% of our total capital is underground development. We've been doing that for a year and a half. So again, subject to some cost increases here and there, but the numbers we've used are real-time numbers, so it shouldn't be overly volatile. But big picture, if you look at our market cap today of $1.1 billion approximately, relative to a capital program that's $138 million, it's not that sensitive, right? So I think it's really important for people to kind of put that in context. And given the balance sheet structure we have, we've baked in extra money. I mean, we've had to raise money for a thing called IVA, which is, again, your working capital, essentially. So the Mexican government charges us 16% for goods and services, and we get it back. But we get it back at the Mexican government's leisure. So that was $50 million. So again, we have that capital earmarked, and it's going to come back to us at some point. So, we made sure that, all the challenges that have come our way, and I am knocking on wood as I say it, are mitigated as best we can. So, again, I think you look at these things and realize small capital, like I would hate to be a company right now trying to move a $1 billion project forward. I mean, I would hate to know what 13% CPI is over a 5-year period of time on a $1 billion project. And that's going to start to come through on the M&A as well. I mean, if you're a producer and you've got 5 assets, you've been doing it for 20 years, you know what you're talking about, you're not in the promotion game. If you're needing to acquire assets, because again, your assets are dwindling over time, that's the nature of the business. Well, you're not buying it if someone hasn't, they got a $500 million CapEx and you don't trust their numbers. They're going to do their work on what that CPI looks like over time. They're going to do their work and see what the margins, how they can withstand those potential changes. So those junior companies that aren't financed, don't have the team, don't have those strong margins, yep, they might do just fine as investment vehicles in the short to medium term, and the silver price or gold price might go up more than those inflation rates. Hope they do for everybody. Just it's just worth noting the other side. So I'm just trying to give a little risk management that we think about at Silvercrest to others that, have their portfolios to think about and have other names that are maybe a little bit more sensitive to the commodity price on the upside.
Yeah, fair enough. And we do need to take a step back and understand that a lot of metal stocks, almost all of them, are pulling back, but you do need to note which ones are weathering the storm a bit better. One quick other question here, talking about large investors. Quite frankly, I feel like the large investors, the generalists, are not paying attention to this sector. It's not necessarily hated, but it's being ignored thanks to all these other sectors that are running much higher and producing some good gains much quicker on for investors. Chris, what do you think it's going to take to bring some of these larger investors and institutions back into the sector?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the dividend yield for the gold sector relative to the S&P and the Dow, the dividend yield's higher. Crescat is a fund out there that does a great job at doing macro as well as stock picking. They've got a beautiful chart that shows the negative free cash flow for the mining sector for the last, for 25 years. So again, you can make money on an operating level, but if you're then taking that money and you're spending it on G&A, overhead, exploration, and if you don't have anything to show for it at the end of the day, investors are saying, this is not a good place to put my money. So I think what's happening now is in the last 12 years, when no one's been in the sector, the companies, the management teams are having to find religion about returning that money to shareholders, having dividends. So I think what you're seeing right now is it was a really healthy washout and the change in sentiment that's in the midst of occurring for these big boys. And right now, the gold price at 1700 is still pretty damn healthy. So again, there's a lot of free cash flow coming through with the seniors. And I think that's going to be, you know, interesting to note, because again, the small guys, the guys who need to raise a bunch more money and get to production, you know, in a less sexy price environment or sentiment environment, navigating those things are tricky. So I think the big guys are in a really good position right now to potentially acquire, to potentially just be patient. But if you just see quarter after quarter of slight dividend increases, capital is going to come. It's just the nature of things, right? Because again, they're called cyclicals for a reason. But the, you know, even the last, you know, 18 months, the balance sheets of the big companies have gotten so much better. So again, I've had a few chats with big funds that have said, hey, I don't really have many inflation hedges in my portfolio, right? So I think for them to sort of go back to that conversation on PE multiples and inflation rates, looking at their portfolios and saying, well, how many high flyers do I have? You know, what happens if inflation does tick up and that historic trend of PE multiples coming down happens to occur? Well, what happens to my portfolio? So again, we're trying to create a structure where we can say, well, okay, we can survive that low price environment. We can add value regardless, that re-rate to cash flow and kicking off cash flow, that we want to be there for the big investors as an appropriate investment vehicle that can be there for 5-10 years. You know, we're serving a purpose in their portfolio as opposed to being a fun speculative stock, right? So I think, you know, for us, we're liquid. We've hopefully created a balance sheet scenario that can withstand a lot of stress and strain and mistakes if we happen to make some, but still is able to add value. I mean, one thing we haven't touched on, that our drill budget for 2021 is equivalent to approximately 75% of all of the drilling we've done since we started the company. So again, if we're one third as efficient ounces as we've been to date, those are highly accretive ounces, right? They're adding to mine life. I mean, one thing in our feasibility study that we laid out, all the money we spent on drilling, if you divide that by the number of years we currently have in hand, you get about $10 million in cost, again, only in the drilling, per year of production. And at $19 silver at the project level, we've got about $100 million of free cash flow. So again, we're happy to be patient. We want to take that three-year view. We've been very fortunate in how we've been able to allocate capital so far. We want time. And I think, again, we're trying to create a vehicle where that time is on our side. And I think for a lot of other people, time means more inflation. Time means I can't access capital. Time is not on, you know, time dwindling reserves and resources without being able to replenish them. So again, these low margin, high cost names or earlier stage names, I think as long as people recognize they have different risk profiles. So those big, large investors, I don't think they're coming down cap for those sorts of vehicles. So they're coming to the guys that can withstand a downturn, can add value. And, you know, one names like us that might eventually end up in portfolios of bigger companies, you know, for that downside production. Right. You know, for that free cash flow profile. So again, there's the speculative fun stuff that everybody gets excited about. And then there's the business of, you know, managing a company. And again, the types of names you're talking about in that audience are much, much, much smaller. And we're, you know, I'd like to say we're in that crowd in terms of asset quality and balance sheet and having the team to actually be able to do it. Some people will say, well, you're not producing yet. And I'll say, hopefully it's pretty much around the corner for us. But again, there's a limited number of vehicles out there that can really do well for people in a downturn, but certainly have many levers to pull in an upturn. So I just think we like this market. You know, we think it shakes out the weak hands, but we also know those hands come back if and when things get a little bit more fun. So again, we're going after those big investors. We're going after the family offices. You know, we're going after the ESG related energy metals type trade as well. You know, and you know, if this momentum keeps kicking in, it's going to come our way. It's the momentum is far too strong. It's just right now, it's just not as sexy as some other things.
No, but I think the big takeaway here is, and especially over this recent correction, just goes to show that you do want some of that downside protection, some of that built-in value in these stocks. And that is what hopefully some of these larger investors will look to. But yeah, they're still largely out of the market. But either way, all you can do is protect your shareholders on the downside and keep on doing the work that you need to do to move the company forward. And you know what, Chris, we will be following up with you as some more news hits the market. But again, I just wanted to bring you back on because a lot of people were asking for a bit more general macro comments on the silver space. And I hope that that helped everybody understand a little bit more what's going on in silver. Chris, I appreciate your time, buddy. Thank you again, and we'll chat again soon. Have a great rest of your week.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Corey. Take care.